The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free Arfcom do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free Arfcom, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free Arfcom, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begin.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we go.
Let's go.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free Arfcom starts now.
Hello, everybody. This is Radio Free Arfcom, your favorite internet radio show. I am your host, John Gold, and we have yet another great show lined up for you today. Today's show, we'll start off with Joe DeBurgolis, our resident NRA board member. And then straight from him, we're going to go straight to Israel, live from Israel, Ted Bellman. He's the blogger from IsraPundit.com. He's an expert on all the political situations in the Middle East and Israel in specific, and he's got a lot of good information to share with us. After that, we are going to get a live get-to-know segment with the man, the myth, Ed Sr., the one and only. That's right, Ed Avila Sr. is going to be on live for a get-to-know segment. And then after him, we have Mike Vanderbilt coming back on the show. We had him on 2 weeks ago. He's going to talk about the arrests of the Haredi militia guys in Michigan this last week, some of the fallout from his window war campaign, and some stuff like that. So we got a great show. Stay tuned. Kick back. Get yourself a drink and enjoy the next couple of hours here on Radio Free Arfcom. Let's start out with Joe DeBurgolis, as we always do every show. We start out with the heavy hitter. Joe, how are you today?
Fantastic, John. How you doing?
Doing great. It's good to hear your voice as usual each week. Come on, you're always welcome on the show anytime you'd like to be here. We love having you on every single week. Before we get started with some of the topics I wanted to talk to you today, I want to tease a little bit. You and I have been working on something, mostly you, have really been putting together a great show we're going to have coming up at the end of this month. And just want to kind of let everybody know we've got something big planned in the works, so I want everyone to be ready for that, right?
No, we do, John. We got a great show in a couple weeks. It's going to be something a little departure from what we normally do here at Radio Free Arfcom. And it's going to be something that's going to be effective. It's something that's going to engage the members of Arfcom, and hopefully we're going to see a positive result as the end result of our action we're going to take on that day.
I'm really excited for it. We'll tease everybody a little bit more each week, and I think next week we'll have some more information. We'll be able to disclose a little bit more. Is that right?
Yes, we will. We have more concrete. We have a guest list and a lineup of where we're going to proceed. It's going to be a good time for everybody in Arfcom to mark down the calendars. I believe we're going to do it April 26th.
That's
right. Put that down in your tape planners, in your iPhones. It's going to be a good show.
Yep, mark that down on your calendars, ladies and gentlemen, because that show is one that you will definitely not want to miss. I've got a couple of really good shows this month, and I'm really excited for them, so this should work out real well. Let's get to some gun rights news, Joe, while we have you on here.
Sure.
Let's start off here with the story came out about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, about the Defense Department. They were disposing of used brass casings that the military uses instead of putting them back on the open market. Do I have the story correct?
Yeah, a little flare-up occurred. Basically what it is, John, we worked very hard, NRA, ILA, and a variety of state associations to ensure that any of the expended brass coming from military installations around the country go back to the use of the citizens. So we had a little flare-up last year. We got two of the U.S. senators from Montana, Senator Max Baucus and John Tester, on board, and they really carried the water for us to ensure that in the 2010 Department of Defense Appropriations Act, that none of the items, brass, to include a variety of firearms, are not disposed of in any way other than back to the citizens. Now, there is a little rider in there saying that if it's something that is destroyed and cannot be reloaded, what have you, that can go to a recycling plant. But what transpired this past week is that there was an outside concern, a company, that was advertising to the garrison commanders and the base commanders a way for them to sell this, to this particular company all their expended brass at a premium, and that money can go back to the base commander and the garrison commander's treasury there at the base, for directly at the base.
Oh, wow.
Which basically violates the intent of Congress and the Appropriations Act. So the good people out there in Montana, headed by Gary Marbutt, who heads up the Montana Shooting Sports Association, got on the horn, contacted the Democratic senators out there, both Baucus and Tester, and contacted the NRA. Isla, Chris Cox, and his guys were right on point, and we're working through this now. So as it stands, there's another flare-up. We're on it. We're looking into it. We'll have more news, and I would say in another week.
Good. So the NRA is involved in this, and they are working to get this worked out. Because if you're a reloader, you know, brass is hard enough to find as it is, right?
Oh, most certainly. It's tough to find, especially with the cost of the ammunition that rose unpredictably last year. A lot of guys returned back to reloading, so they can go out there and, on the range and carry on their training, carry on their plinking, or compete in matches. So it's the avenue of this demilitarized brass coming out, or expended brass coming from the military, for use by the civilians, is a major source for the reloaders and the competitors out there who want to reload their own special brand of cartridge.
Right, right. Yeah, it's good to see the NRA fighting once again for our gun rights. Another story where the NRA had something to say, there were these big attacks in Mexico where the cartels were actually attacking the Mexican army. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the past about, especially from the left and the Brady Bunch, that, you know, all these guns are flooding down to Mexico from the United States, and it's just, oh, sounds like we lost Joe a little bit. We'll get Joe back on right away. Don't worry about that. Okay. Anyway, story came out last week for all my listeners here that the cartels actually attacked Mexican army bases and army outposts. And, you know, in the past, there's been all the talk about, oh, these guns are flooding down from the United States, and, you know, they buy them at the gun shows, or there's these straw man purchases, and a lot of the accusations are that it's American guns going down south. We've got Joe back. I just kind of presented the case to our listeners, Joe. Can you talk a little bit about how, basically, the NRA has come to find out that there's no way that most of these guns used by the cartels could have come from the United States?
Well, most certainly, John. What's transpiring down in Mexico is a shame. And what's happening on our southern borders is a bigger shame. You've got the sheriffs on our side in the United States fighting basically a war. And there's been incursions into our country. There's been murders in our country as a result of these Mexican drug cartels. But what transacted last week was that the major drug cartels and their hired troops, and they had their small armies, messed it up with the Mexican federal government and their army. And thankfully, the Mexican federal government came forward. Their army was successful in nullifying the threat posed to them. But in the broader scope of the things, in particular the firearms, they found out that the firearms they were using weren't coming from the United States. They weren't of the semi-automatic variety. The grenades, the fully automatic machine guns, the M16s and all the variants they're carrying were either stolen directly from the Mexican government in their stores or armories, or they're being surprised through nefarious means to the black market. So it really, really shows a flaw in the United States government's stance where these are coming from legitimate, law-abiding citizens.
Yeah, it's scary. You've got Eric Holder using this type of argument to try and get support for another assault weapons ban. But, I mean, you're talking about fully automatic weapons here. You're talking about hand grenades. I mean, these aren't things you can go and buy at a gun show. These aren't things that you can go and straw man purchase for someone the way the Class 3 regulations are. And, of course, the laws over destructive devices. It's just impossible, and it's just mind-boggling the way the left works sometimes.
It truly is. The weapon of choice down there for a lot of the drug cartels is actually AK-47, and those are being brought in for, as we all know, especially our gun aficionados, that there's millions upon millions of these firearms. So they're being brought in from a variety of ways. It's a very sad state of affairs down there, and it's just something where there's a war going on in our southern border, and people have start to wake up and understand what's going on. Our law enforcement are facing outwardly assaults, Border Patrol agents. God bless them and the duty they're doing down there. Custom and Border Protection, our ICE agents are doing a great job. You know, anytime we got to consider putting National Guard on the border, it's unbelievable. And you just look at the great job that Governor Perry is doing down in Texas and putting his Texas Rangers down there and his highway.
Yeah.
The public safety guys, our troopers down there. It's just, in Arizona, they're trying to shore up their attack, if you want to call it that. It's amazing.
Until we get that border secure, I'm worried. Mexico, it's just like on the verge of becoming a failed state.
It's unfortunate. It really is.
Last thing I have for you here, Joe, was one of the outrages of the week from the NRAILA.org. And this was a case that to me, was like, oh my goodness, this could happen to anybody. It was the case of a gun owner named Greg Revell. He was flying from Salt Lake City to Allentown, Pennsylvania. Along the way, he had two stops, one in Minneapolis and one in Newark, New Jersey. So he gets to New Jersey, if I have the story correct, and he's got a flight delay. So he misses his connection to Pennsylvania. And so he books, you know, he tries to get on a bus. He books a later flight. He can't do either because his luggage didn't get there in time. And he's carrying a firearm. It's legally declared. It's legally stored in his checked luggage. There's nothing illegal about it. But now he misses his flight out of New Jersey, so he has to spend the night in New Jersey. And when he comes back to the airport the next day with his luggage and declares that he's got a firearm, they arrest him and put him in jail. Is that right?
That's what happened. It's unfortunate. He's not the first case. There's a few other pending. I had the great honor of meeting Mr. Revell back when the NRA took the case on. And due to the great work of fellow board member Scott Bach and Tom King, our president here of the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, a fellow board member, we're looking into this. Basically what's happening, John, is when people fly into Newark, New Jersey, the Port Authority Police, which has jurisdiction both in New Jersey and New York, are there and they're the responding police agency. But the way the laws are is that when a law-abiding individual checks his or her luggage, checks the firearm in his or her luggage, declares that the TSA follows all the regulations and rules. When they fly through Newark, if they're delayed for any reason and need to be put back with their luggage, so they're technically in possession of their firearm, they're in violation of the law. And it's a shame. We're looking into it. The NRA Civil Rights Defense Fund came to the aid of Mr. Revell. We're monitoring this very closely. But we're not asleep at the switch at all with this. We're at the forefront of this. We're going to make sure at some point, either legislatively or through other means, that this situation is rectified.
Yeah, that's crazy. He spent 4 days in a New York jail. He eventually was cleared on all charges, but he didn't get his firearms back for 3 years. Yeah, that's ridiculous. But the NRA Civil Rights Defense Fund came to his aid. They helped him. They're also helping him with he's actually suing for an unjust arrest and detention. Is that right? And that's going through appeals now.
that's going through the appeal process. We're going to monitor that. There's a couple others that are pending. We should hear a verdict on those shortly. It's something that we've been involved with for several years now, but I got to give kudos out to Scott Bach and Tom King. They did a great job with those, for trying to anyways.
Yeah, it's great to see the NRA stepping up for gun owners. I loved it. I love it when there's tangible stories we can relate to people and say, look, the NRA is working for you. The NRA is working for you. So if you're a gun owner, you're not a member of the NRA, you know how to join. Go to NRA.com. If you want any news on gun rights news or gun laws news, please go to NRAILA.org. It's a great website. They cover everything. They do it state by state. If you're curious about your state, you can go to the map and click on your state. Thanks for being on, Joe. As usual, I know you're busy this evening. I appreciate you cutting some time out for us every week.
Have a great show, John.
Will do. And I just want to remind everybody, Joe is putting together this amazing show coming up. April 26th, I believe, is when we're going to have it. Mark it on your calendars. I promise you will be sick if you miss this show. You will be sick. Our next guest coming up is an expert on all things Israel in the Middle East. His name's Ted Bellman, and his website is israpundit.com, israpundit.com. We are trying to get Ted in right now. We have Ted on?
Yep, here.
Ted, how are you? Coming live from Israel. I really appreciate you staying up late. It's the middle of the night over there, and we really appreciate you staying up late to be on the show with us.
Okay, thanks. I'm looking forward to it.
This should be great. I have so many questions for you, so let's just get started right away because I know I'm going to run out of time with you because I just have a million questions for you. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about your background, how you got involved covering Israel and where you came from and that type of thing.
I'm originally from Canada, Toronto specifically. I practiced law for a number of years, started a business, and was always somewhat politically conscious. And 20 years ago, my daughter moved to Israel, and I guess I just followed her last year, actually, and rather happy to be here. So, and for the last 10 years, I've been running this website, Israel Pundit. It's got a strong audience, and it's both news and views, and so that keeps me busy all day, better than being retired. That's it.
That's great. So, I've been following your blog since I found it, and it's just your website. It's just I can't believe that you just bring in news from everywhere and all these different views, and it's just amazing some of the stuff you have. Now, some of the questions I have, just you know, as an American, and we kind of follow Israel as just your average American. You hear this about Hez and this about Hamas. Can you kind of tell everybody what's the real differences between Hezbollah and Hamas, and how they're different, and kind of how they're the differences between the two and who they are?
Starting with Hamas, they are part of the Muslim Brotherhood that was started in 1928, I think, connections to Nazism. In any event, in their charter, they're dedicated to the destruction of Israel. Say what you will about anything, will people talk to them, whatever, they cannot accept Israel in the Middle East, and they're out to destroy Israel. They are located in the Gaza Strip now, which Israel vacated 5 years ago. And Israel gets a lot of pressure that we should be treating them nicely, and we just had a war a year ago with them. We didn't finish them off. And maybe that was a mistake, but they're still there. They're still sending rockets. They just killed two Israeli soldiers last week, and so it goes. So that's Hamas. They also are very popular in the West Bank, which we call Judea and Samaria. But at the moment, the U.S. is supporting Fatah, and if they weren't, Hamas would take over. Now, Fatah, that's Abu Mazen, he's at the head of it, they also have in their charter, that's Arafat's former party when he was alive, they also have in their charter the destruction of Israel. So when they say they want to end the occupation, they don't limit the occupation just to the West Bank. They say all of Israel is occupied territory because Israel should never have been created. So you have to be very much aware of the reality, and although the United States is trying to paint them as moderates, that's just a total line of BS to present them as a reasonable party for making a peace deal. The fact remains is they're dedicated to our destruction, and there's anti-Israel hate speech constantly in their schools, their textbooks, in their television. Throughout, everything in Judea and Samaria is hate speech when it comes to Jews.
Right.
Now, Hezbollah is located up in Lebanon, and they are a branch, or they're totally a proxy for Iran. And Syria is in the Iranian camp, and they've been supplying Hezbollah with rockets. Now, you guys are into firearms and whatever. How would you like to have 60,000 rockets aimed at you from northern Mexico and another 40,000 aimed at you from Canada? And you're big. Here we are, just like 50 miles wide, and that's how many rockets Hezbollah and Hamas have combined.
Wow. I had no idea they had that many. You hear about rocket attacks, but you don't realize that they're in the tens.
They only send off one or two at a time, which adds up. Before this war a year ago, 8,000 over a period of time they kept sending, and they can't aim them, so they're totally a terror weapon because they send it into civilian areas. But now they've restocked, and they've got like 40,000 there, we're told, and 60,000 in Lebanon, which means that if Israel ever tried to have a fight to clean up the problem, or, for instance, to bomb Iran, they're going to have 100,000 rockets coming in.
Wow. That's crazy for as small.
Scary,
as,
right?
Yeah.
What the hell am I doing here?
That is scary. Just looking down the point, you're looking down the barrel of a gun, literally. So who is the bigger threat to Israel? Is it Hamas? Is it Hezbollah? Is it both of them?
Well,
is it Iran?
This will surprise you. It's Obama.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I wrote an article quite some time ago, and I said the peace process is a bigger danger to Israel than Hamas.
Wow.
Now, why, and I have to explain that, that's very important for Americans to understand. We can deal with Hamas, and we can deal with Hezbollah. One way or another, we'll get a bloody nose, but we'll wipe them out. So it's not an existential threat.
Okay.
But United States, ever since we were created, in many ways has been our enemy. And I'll explain why. The United States had an arms embargo on Israel for 20 years, from 1948 to 1968, they didn't sell us any arms. We had no relationship with America. And in 1956, Eisenhower forced us to retreat from the Sinai. There was a Sinai War. We were on the side of Britain and France against Egypt. And the United States got involved and ordered us to retreat, which we did. Now, after the war, And the 67 war ended. It was the most amazing war in all history. In 6 days, Israel defeated Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, who were helped by Iraq. It was an amazing war, and because Israel did it so efficiently and so quickly. Any event,
I remember reading about that. It was over really quick, and Israel just wiped everybody out, if I remember correctly.
Unbelievable how they accomplished it. But in any event, rather than let the situation be because we had defeated our enemies, the Security Council immediately got on the scene and passed a resolution dictating that we should get out of all the conquered territory in exchange for peace. Now, what was it their business? We were attacked in a defensive war, and when you win a war, you keep the territory. There's got to be a cost to people who wage war, right? But here they passed a resolution saying that basically the idea of land for peace, we had a retreat from the Sinai, retreat from the West Bank, retreat from Gaza, retreat from the Golan Heights in exchange for peace. Now, the resolution, when it was passed, allowed for us to have secure borders. Because everyone recognized in our narrowest waistband in the middle of Israel were only 9 miles wide.
Right.
So, and the land rises from there, so Arabs could be 10 miles away, elevated, and they can see the sea and see Tel Aviv and see everything. And being on high ground gives you a tremendous advantage when it comes to firing rockets and doing trouble. So there were many people thought that, you know, we should have more secure borders. And also, part of these lands are like 5 miles away from our international airport. This is how tight everything is in Israel.
Yeah, everything's just right on top of each other.
Absolutely. Small country from the Dead Sea to the Mediterranean, 50 miles. The whole width of the country, 50 miles. So that gives you a bit of a picture of it. Now, the
How does the Obama policy come into where he's the biggest threat now to Israel?
Because America committed to forcing Israel to give up this territory, and they committed to Saudi Arabia. So ever since the mid-70s, when the oil embargo was on, America has been doing their best to force us back to the borders prior to the war. Now, they've also done friendly things for us, but they are committed to making us retreat and give up the territory. That's the starting point. The friendly things, they protect us in the Security Council by vetoing horrendous resolutions. So that's the main thing. But in every war we get involved, they always stop the war, don't let us win the war. Why? Because they're committed to the Arabs to not let us win and not let us dominate them. Now, the difference between... So the State Department is fully committed to this, and they have been for 40 years, to return us to our original borders. And the peace process is a tool that they use to impose their will on us. As opposed to just leaving us alone to work it out with the Arabs, they are imposing their will on us and not letting us work it out. They're dictating how it gets worked out. Now, the difference between Obama and the other presidents, in a way, were paying lip service. They were gently pushing us, but never... I can't say that. Bush Sr. pushed us seriously. Different people at various times forced us to make concessions we didn't want to make. Obama, he's hell-bent for it. He has now demanded not even secure borders he's allowing us. And he wants us to give up half of Jerusalem. And he's twisting Netanyahu's arm. He's really dedicated to absolutely overwhelming Israel with threats, dire threats, won't let them attack Iran to protect themselves, which they want to do. And he's forcing Israel to do his bidding, or he's going to totally allow economic sanctions against Israel, prevent us from defending ourselves by attacking Iran. So that's who Obama is.
So is there any chance that Israel would strike unilaterally against Iran, even without the United States backing them up or the United States' permission?
Well, it's worse than that, because United States, as a matter of fact, Brzezinski said that the United States will shoot us out of the sky. We don't have air rights to get to Iran. Iran, I think, is... something like 1,500 miles away, or maybe even more. I don't know. It's a long time to get there, and we don't have any air rights. So you don't just fly over a country because you want to attack another country. You have to find a path to get to the country where you have air rights. And if we fly over Iraq, America has threatened to shoot us down. So that's one problem. The other problem is we're very, very close to the United States militarily. The American military love us, and we help them tremendously, and our technological innovations are a terrific benefit for the for America, saves American lives. So we're in close with the military. We taught them how to fight in Iraq because we were fighting, you know, in Arab towns. We knew what insurgencies were. So we keep educating them. We educate the U.S. Police also in anti-terror and all kinds of things. Everybody comes to Israel to learn how to do it.
Right.
Okay. So
yeah, you guys have been living with it for so long, you would probably
exactly. Yeah, necessity is the mother of invention, and we have all kinds of techniques, even airport security. We don't have all the shoe business and all that type of thing. And yet now everybody's starting to copy what we do in Israel. And what they do in Israel is, first of all, we profile. And I can't understand, I mean, the left in America won't allow profiling, and that's crazy. But in any event, so we have very, very smart interviewers who have been trained to look you in the eye and ask you questions. And based on your emotional reactions and your eyeballs and your pupils and your this and your that, they can tell whether they have to have you searched. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, and you guys haven't had a major terrorist attack.
That's
on
right.
Any of your airlines.
And we're only protected by these interviewers.
Yeah,
so
they must be real professionals then.
Well, they're trained, and they're smart. They're not flunkies, whereas all the security people you have in the U.S. airports are basically flunkies. They're not hired for their intelligence.
No, some of the TSA employees we have, you read some of these stories, there's already – we put in the airport scanners, and we've already had an incident of someone surreptitiously taking images off the airport scanner, the body scanner. So it's just, yeah, some of the TSA employees, I will admit, I'm not sure I have a total faith in them, especially to stop a terrorist attack, you know, let alone whatever else they're doing with these body scanners. Now,
yeah.
I've read that Obama says he wants to create a Palestinian state. That's one of his goals before he gets out of office. If there is an official Palestinian state, how does that affect Israel?
Well, first of all, there's a border issue. Israel wants to retain land because at the moment, Israel has close to 600,000 Jews living in land that Obama wants for the Palestinians. 600,000. Now, the Arabs, they don't want any Jews to live in any land that goes back to them. And Obama is supporting the whole idea. I mean, we have in Israel 800,000 Arabs living in Israel, full citizens, vote, members of parliament, the whole bit. And here, the Arabs in the West Bank, they come along and they say they want all Jews out. And here America is supporting that idea. And it's really extremely racist. And yet, the whole international world supports it. Why? Because they don't care about anything except pleasing the Arabs. Whatever the Arabs want, they get.
Right.
And they want it back. Now, so Israel, first of all, wants to have adjustments to the borders, so at least 500,000 of these Israelis who are very close to our borders don't have to move. So that's the first issue. The second issue is we've given up a lot of territory, and it didn't get us peace. Now, we do not believe that if we pull out of Judea and Samaria, we will then have peace. So what we'll have is less control over the Arabs, who continue to demonize us, delegitimate us, and terrorize us. We don't believe it'll achieve peace. That's basic.
Okay.
So
you say on your blog, you have the statement at the very top of your blog, actually. It says, no diplomatic solution. How, Go ahead and explain that.
Well, this is what it means. At the moment, everybody who believes in the peace process says everybody knows what the deal is going to be, okay? And yet, the deal is very close. There's the Israeli offer and the Arab offer, and there only may be 3%, 4% difference in the total amount of land. Israel wants to keep maybe 5% of the land. And the Arabs maybe will let us keep 1% of the land. So look how close that is. But nobody is going to compromise anymore. There is no deal here. Israel isn't going to compromise on that, and the Arabs aren't going to compromise. Therefore, there's no diplomatic solution.
So this whole peace process and getting people back to the table, and we'll offer this if you come back to the table and go, it's basically a pipe dream, is what you're saying?
Yeah, totally. It's an illusion. It's just to carry on like you have a peace process, but nobody believes a deal will come out of it. That's one of the reasons Obama is strong-arming Israel as much as he is. He's trying to force Israel to give up that 5% and with no protection in mind.
So here's a question I have about Obama. We knew he was sympathetic to Muslims. We knew he grew up in a Muslim family. He grew up Muslim. Yeah. He's always been sympathetic to him. And I don't understand how did so many Jews end up voting for him?
That's the hardest question of all to answer. Obviously we weren't the only ones, but the Jews voted overwhelmingly for him. Because he dismissed, first of all, the Jews are the most liberal people you'll find anywhere. They tolerate everybody. So, they were at the forefront of the civil rights movement. That's their shtick, to be tolerant and all-embracing. That's the starting point. So they were the last people that were going to reject a black man and reject a Muslim, because their highest principle is tolerance. Okay, that's the starting point.
But in the end, you'd think that you'd be more worried about self-preservation than tolerance at some point.
You would think so. Now, whereas maybe 75% of Jews in America voted for Obama, in Israel, 75% of the Israelis at that time didn't like him, the reverse. And now he's only got a support of like 6 to 8% of Israelis support him,
right,
and what he's doing.
That makes sense.
So, and the Orthodox in America are also did not vote for Obama. They're totally different. They're not ruled by this liberalism. Okay.
So what's now, the difference? Just real quick
before
you go further, what is the difference? You always hear Orthodox Jew, and what's the difference between an Orthodox Jew and a regular Jew? Is it just they follow a much stricter interpretation?
Well, that's it. Basically, the Orthodox believe that all the commandments in our Torah, otherwise known as the Old Testament, but it was the Testament. It's our Torah. It's the Bible.
Right.
Provides all kinds of rules that are to be followed, and the Orthodox follow them religiously. That's the first point. Now, the Reform, which is like 80% of American Jewry, they've taken the position that all the obligations, the rules that the Orthodox follow are not binding. So they don't follow any of them.
Okay.
Now, what distinguishes a Jew from a Christian is that we don't believe the Messiah came.
Right.
Now, that's whether you're Reform or Orthodox. That's the basic distinction. We don't believe that the Messiah has come. And I might add that today the political divide is not Christians versus Jews. The political divide is right and left. So there's a huge amount of Christians, evangelicals are all on the right, and they are very strong friends of Israel. And yet there's also a Christian left movement, Presbyterian and whatever, who are against Israel. So there's Jews and Christians on the right and Jews and Christians on the left.
Okay.
That's the divide.
So, right. And you say that all of the Orthodox Jews, they were against Obama from the get-go.
Not all. You know, I said 75.
But most. Right. Okay.
Right. Now they don't worship at the somebody called it the Torah of liberalism. Judaism is liberal in ways, but it's also self-preserving in ways. And you know, if a man comes to kill you, kill him first, which is one of the basic tenets that's enunciated. You shouldn't take it lying down. You have to defend yourself. That's an obligation. So. Now, the Jewish community in America, now that they see how bad Obama is, they're starting to break away from him and return the support from them. Ed Koch, for instance, the former mayor of New York, voted for him, and he's changed. A lot of prominent figures have now seen the light. And I was against Obama from the start. But I might mention regarding Obama, you mentioned you knew a little bit about his Muslim background or whatever. He's still a Muslim. And he never converted. And I urge all your readers to visit my site, and I just posted a video of Obama's speeches. And if you're a patriotic American, you'll throw up.
Yeah, I throw up if I have to hear his voice for more than like two words, but I'm definitely going to go.
The things that he says are out and out lies, but he also admits he's a Muslim in these. And he says America will never be at war with Islam, and Islam has been part of American history ever since its founding. Like things that are so incredibly false. And he's bowing down to the Saudi king to show his, his fealty to him. I mean, it's so sickening. And he is so anti-American, Obama.
Oh, no question.
As the left generally is anti-American, and so you know, I pray for the Tea Party movement, and for you know, I'm so happy that the Obamacare got passed because that has really mobilized people to bring them down.
I hope it works. I hope we can bring them down. I'm not happy that it passed, just because I think it's so big that it's something that it will never be repealed.
Well, it has to get repealed. Yeah, absolutely. It's a catalyst. But another good thing that he's doing, this in a way is a flirtation. The Americans are flirting with socialism. Well, I think they've learned their lesson. They ain't going to go back there again.
No, you know? I don't think we will after this guy. I think he has ruined it for any future lefties for quite a while. I really hope
he has. Exactly.
Once again, for all my listeners, we're on with Ted Bellman. He's live from Israel. His website is israpundit.com, israpundit.com. He's got all kinds of information up there. He updates it several times a day. Everything about Israel and the Middle East, the situation going on over there. The big news lately is that Iran, it's been said that they could already have weaponized their nuclear program. They could actually already have a weapon and no one know it. If it turns out that Iran does have a nuclear weapon, how does that impact Israel?
Well, from what I read, Israel's not going to let it happen. And they've got about till November. One very knowledgeable person said that Israel will attack before the end of November.
Now, so they will go by themselves if they have to. They'll find that.
If they have to. And they may even use clean nuclear weapons.
Oh, what's a clean nuclear weapon? I'm not familiar with that.
Well, one of the issues with the dirty bombs, as they're called, is that the radioactive material kills you and makes you sick.
Right.
And a clean bomb doesn't have that issue.
Oh, wow. I have never heard of those. So they would use those in lieu of bunker
buses,
right?
These things are so deep in the ground. It's unbelievable. I think they're 6 to 10 stories deep.
Oh, wow.
And Obama, Yeah, the nuclear facilities are all way underground and reinforced with concrete at every level going down. So, I mean, if you're going to grab the tiger by the tail, you got to make sure you can handle them. And if you don't have the bombs that will totally wipe this out, you better not mess with the tiger.
Right.
You know, I mean, you got to do the job.
Right.
Now, America is making it all the more necessary that we do the job that way, because they're not helping us, right? They're bringing this about.
Policy-wise?
Yeah, but they won't sell us bunker buster bombs. They've had embargo for a couple of years, right? So they won't do that. Let me get into one other thing that I think is very important. Part of what the West is doing, and it's not just the Arabs, they're totally supported by Europe, and to a lesser extent, they're supported by America. They are demonizing Israel and making us look bad, but it's all lies. The Goldstone Report sort of accused us of war crimes in the war a year ago on Gaza. Total bullshit. And they're lying, putting us on the defensive, and making us look bad because they want to undermine us. So the only people predominantly who are above all that are the American people who support Israel in this fight with the Palestinians 8-1. So the Americans, they're not following their State Department. They like Israel. And in Europe, it's the other way around. Everywhere else, there's so much anti-Semitism. Jews are being beaten up all over the place. You can't go on the street and in any way identify yourself as a Jew if you want to get home safe. This is in many parts of Europe now. Very serious.
Yeah, there's been a big movement towards the, I don't know how you'd phrase it, the Islamization of Europe. There's some of these countries now have imposed Sharia law in places.
America too. You don't know what's happening, but it's happening. And it's happening because America's letting it happen. And they are as committed to taking over America as they are Europe and enforcing Sharia law. And America isn't stopping it. And they're actually accommodating them. You'll see, there's a whole host of things that America's allowing this to happen. And they're in bed with this organization, CAIR, C-A-I-R. It's an acronym. And they're just a front for the Muslim Brotherhood, who are dedicated to destroying America. And yet, the FBI meets with them, and they discuss how they're going to do this and how they're going to do that, as opposed to, 60 years ago, the Communist Party was outlawed because they were a threat to American democracy.
Right.
So, and Islam, I guess your readers have to understand what's wrong with Islam. The key thing, Islam is an ideology like Nazism or communism. It wants to dominate the world. That's the first thing. When they talk about peace, they believe there will only be peace when Islam is in the total. So, for instance, America won't be at peace until Islam is a dominant religion in America. So that's what peace means to them. Islam has to be dominant. Secondly, many places in the Quran call for the conversion or killing of infidels, and infidels include you and me.
Right.
Christians and Jews are identified as infidels.
I don't think you'll get you won't get a whole lot of love from our listeners here. We've got so many former military, foreign law enforcement, and the civilians that listen here, we understand what Islam is and the threat that it poses to our country.
Well, that's great. It's extremely important to understand, to know the reality. And the American government is making it very difficult for you to know the reality, because you don't talk about these things. Because if you are against a religion, it's racism. But right. It's a political ideology that you want to stop dead in its tracks. And the key message is our way or the highway. They should adapt to us, not us adapting to them.
Yeah, and I think you brought up an interesting point there that Islam is not just a religious ideology. It is a political ideology. They do want to control every aspect of your life. There's not a lot of freedom. There's not a lot of tolerance. They can
spin it how they want,
but there just isn't. Let me ask you a couple questions about – sorry to interrupt you, Tim, but let me ask you a couple questions about the political situation in Israel right now. What kind of position is Netanyahu in right now? Where do you see things changing?
No, I don't. Netanyahu is very strong, although Obama's trying to bring him down. Netanyahu is obviously elected by the Israeli people. All the parties are center-right in his coalition, so they're going to stick there. They don't want him to give in to Obama. It's a very difficult thing for them because they're going to give away their birthright. All this land, the occupation, by the way, legally is not illegal. The settlements are not illegal. And this is a legal opinion. And you come to my site and I can, you know, I can provide all this stuff for you. In the British mandate gave us the right to live in the West Bank and it gave it to us politically. And everybody wants to deny that now. But that's the dominant basis for our rights to Judea and Samaria. And yet America is saying that our settlements are illegal, everything's illegal, because they're trying to delegitimate us and undermine our creation in the first place. So that's another story you don't accept right off the bat. So I'm sure, and politically, most of the parties are on the right. We played the peace game before. It came back and bit us on the ass, as they say. We retreated from Lebanon and we ended up with a war with Hezbollah. We retreated from Gaza. We ended up with a war with them. We're not about to retreat from the West Bank if we can help it. But Obama is putting such enormous pressure on us, hoping that we'll crack. That's where it is.
What would be the impact if Obama went so far as to pull all American support, all financial aid from Israel? How bad would that
be? We don't need the money. That's another BS line. We don't need the $3 billion. And the left is always complaining we're the biggest recipient of aid. You may have heard that. We don't need the money. Of that money, only $600 million comes to us. I'll leave that aside for a minute. The other $2.4 billion is a credit line for us to buy U.S. military equipment to keep U.S. workers working. But it's more than that, because once they give us $2.4 billion, they're giving the same amount to the Arabs, and they wouldn't be able to give it to them if they didn't give it to us. So that money produces a lot of jobs in America. No problem. So that's the first issue, why America doesn't want to cut it off. They want to give it to us. From our point of view, part of the deal is we can't compete with American industry. We have many innovations that we want to be able to go and sell, and they tie our hands, and they don't let us sell to China, and they don't let us sell to India. They don't let us sell, to some extent, to Russia. So when we get this, we end up being hampered industry-wise in competing in the world market. So there's another negative. Now, another negative on top of that is everything we buy from the United States is more expensive than what it would cost us to produce on our own or to buy from somebody else. But another reason America wants us to keep taking the money is because they control us that way. So, many people have said, if not for Israel, America would need another aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean. We are such an important military asset to America. We can mobilize an army of 500,000 people within 48 hours. You know how long it took America to send 500,000 people to Iraq? Over 6 months. We are an enormous benefit. And
that's an impressive figure, you could mobilize that many people in such a short period of time. That's pretty impressive, actually.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. Maybe the full mobilization will take more. But,
sure.
And not more. It's like we only have a standing army of 40,000 people in the midst of all this, you know, rockets and everything facing us. And we've got a very sophisticated system for mobilizing quickly. And the first mobilization takes 48 hours. Maybe that's 100,000, I don't know, as opposed to 400. Because you can't clog the roads, right? How the hell do you get to your base if all of a sudden you have 5,000 people? Yeah.
So, Ted, you said that you think, and you have it on good information, that Israel will strike Iran, whether they have to do it by themselves or not, before November, right?
Well, first of all, that's one person's opinion. The predominance of opinion, but that doesn't guarantee it. Just let me put it that way.
Let's just play a hypothetical then.
Yeah.
If Israel does attack Iran, does that mean instantly they're going to be at war with Hezbollah and with Hamas? I mean, it seems like as soon as there is any attack on Iran, Hezbollah and Hamas will go full speed ahead.
Right. That's what we're expecting.
So it's not going to be just, okay, we're going to go attack Iran. It's going to be...
No. Oh, it's going to be bloody war. Tens of thousands of rockets are coming in. Meanwhile, we're trying to use our planes to clean. It's going to be 10 days over Iran to wipe out all their facilities. 10 days. And during that 10-day period, if we have all our planes up there, what planes are we going to have here to defend us from the rockets? So it's not a small matter. I mean, if we do that, we're going to take an enormous hit. No question about it. But it won't be an existential hit. And that's why Israel's prepared to do it.
You've blogged a little bit in the past about Sarah Palin, and I take it you like her. You like where she comes from. What is the average Israeli opinion on Sarah Palin?
Well, they recognize her as a big friend of Israel. She would not do what Obama does. But forget about the Israeli point of view, don't forget I'm a North American, and I follow it from their point of view, and I see how much she is vilified by the liberal left. I mean, it is incredible. And they use lies, they use whatever, because they want more negative headlines and negative stories out there than positive stories. So in order to get these negative stories, they have to lie and distort stuff so they have something negative to talk about. But they want to keep up enormous pressure so she doesn't get a better reception among Americans. They're making her somebody that intellectuals, for instance, are afraid to come near for fear that everybody will attack them and say, oh, how can you go for that dummy, and so on, right? There's an inhibiting factor there, a chill factor, as a result of all the stuff they say. For instance, they look at her as a Christian fundamentalist, which to the liberal left, that's a bad thing. They also look at her as an extremist. Yet, if you look at her policies, there's nothing extreme about them. Here she was supporting McCain, for instance, in Alaska. She brought Democrats into her cabinet, and she often worked across the aisle. She is not an extreme person, and her policies aren't extreme. And yet she's characterized that way. Now, as far...
The left is definitely afraid of her. I mean, she did more for the McCain campaign than McCain ever did on his own. So,
He brought it down. Now, it's a little mixed bag because Republicans are also afraid of her because they feel she's not centrist enough. And a lot of people say there's no difference between center-right Republicans and center-left Democrats. They could go back and forth across the aisle. There's certainly a difference. And that's true, especially in Bush's second term. He became a big spender and whatever. Very little difference from the center. So what Sarah Palin is doing is forcing the polarization of the right, not letting the right be in the middle. And she's fighting for these primaries that will be competitive, where people are being committed. Republican nominees are committed to right-wing financial policies. And she's forcing the issue, so preventing people who are like Scott Safaza, whatever her name was, who was too centrist for her. And so she fought against her. So she's trying to really make a difference between who's running for office in the Republicans and who the Democrats. It's a polarizing choice is what she's decided to do. So that means the people in the middle are going to have to say, gee, who's more extreme, Obama or Palin? I can't stand Obama, right? I mean, she's making people choose. She's making a difference. But I don't think she's extremist at all.
What is your take on Ron Paul?
Well, first of all, he's anti-Israel. And he's a bit of like Buchanan, isn't he? He's an isolationist also. He believes America should withdraw from the world. That's my impression. I don't know much about him. But Paul Ryan, he's a good guy. Rubio, great guy. There's some Michelle Bachmann, love her.
Yeah, I like Michelle Bachmann too.
There's
some good conservatives.
People.
There are some great conservatives.
Absolutely.
It's a shame that the GOP is afraid of them because they're not center enough. Just like you said,
exactly.
It bothers me about the GOP. I'd like to see the GOP take a huge step to the right.
I think they don't have a choice. Sarah Palin is too dominant. And as I've written, if people want to read the stuff I've written about Sarah, it's fun to read. If you just go to our site, there's a box there for searching. And just search Palin. And all my articles on Palin will come up, and you can see them.
Hey, Ted, we're out of time here. I really appreciate you staying up late. What is it, 2 o'clock in the morning there?
Well, more like quarter to 3, I think.
Quarter to 3. Hey, I really appreciate it.
3 o'clock.
I really appreciate you staying up and giving us this insider insight. This is information and a viewpoint we couldn't get anywhere else. And as things progress in the Middle East and new news comes out, we'd love to have you on the show again.
As much as you like, give me a shout. I hope your listeners weren't overwhelmed by all the information. Usually I talk to audiences who know a great deal, and I only have to fill in the blanks. But here I had to go back to the 101 course. But that's
sure
good.
Me,
that's a start.
I'm sure for me, it was mostly for me. Most of our listeners know so much more about it than I do. There's always a good heated discussion going on about something in the Middle East or Israel on our website. So we really appreciate it. This was Ted Bellman from IsraPundit.com. Check out his blog. It's a great website. Lots of information about the Middle East. Lots of insider information and takes that you wouldn't get anywhere else. IsraPundit.com. And thanks again, Ted.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, this is the moment everybody has been waiting for. We have the man, the myth, the legend, Ed Sr. is on with us. How are you today, Ed?
I'm fine, John. How are you?
Doing well. It's just so great to have you on. It was a goal of mine to get you on, and I don't even know how to say how happy I am to have you on. I gave you the list of the questions. Are you ready to go?
Sure.
Let's do it, then. Let's start off with the ubiquitous 9mm, Ed, or 45?
Oh, well, if I want to put holes together pretty close, I use the 9, but if I want to stop a thread, then I use a 45, of course.
So I guess we'll say 45 on that one?
I carry a 45.
No surprise there. All right, the other big question that haunts ARFCOMers in their nightly slumber, beans or no beans?
If we're talking about chili, you got to put beans in it. Otherwise, you're eating sloppy joes.
I love it. So you heard it straight from the man, you guys. Beans in chili.
Those Texans, they insist not to put beans in them, but otherwise you're eating sloppy joes. That's what we call that chili without beans over here.
I love it. So I think I know the answer to this question. Your preferred sidearm, is it a Glock? Is it a 1911, or is it something else?
No, I prefer a 1911 over anything.
Okay.
Second close will be a SIG. And
oh,
I do
SIG. Okay.
Carry a SIG, sometimes a 239 when I don't want to carry a heavier, bigger weapon, or a 220 if I don't mind the bulk. But generally I carry a 1911 and not the SIGs, generally.
Okay, outstanding. 1911, it is.
1911.
So, what do you do for a living now, Ed? I, I'm pretty sure I think you're retired.
I'm a pathologist, but not a forensic pathologist.
Oh.
I'm what's called a surgical pathologist, and that means that that I look at biopsies, pieces of tissue, or sometimes a whole segment of an organ, like a segment of colon or a piece of lung or something like that, and then I give the generally surgeons, but also dermatologists and other people, gastroenterologists will take biopsies when they do colonoscopies, and we render a diagnosis, and based on that, then they know what they're dealing with in terms of what disease they have to deal with, and then they treat the patient accordingly.
Oh, that's interesting.
Surgeons, of course, want to know if it's malignant or benign, and we do it oftentimes at the time of the operation. We freeze the tissue instead of processing it through the normal way, which takes hours, and we don't get the same quality of section, but we can give them a diagnosis 99.9% of the times as to what they're dealing with, and then they decide whether they have to resect it or they don't have to.
Right. See, in all this time, I thought you were going to be retired. I had no idea you were a doctor. So do we have to call you Dr. Ed Sr. now?
No, I tell everybody that I'm Ed. I'm Ed Sr. for some people, and that's how I like it. The only problem is it brings confusion with Edward, my son, and I can't tell you how many times I'm talking to someone, they will be saying something to me, and it sounds like I should know what the heck they're talking about, but I have no idea. And then as I leave and I tell one of my other sons, like a CHOT show, they say, Dad, he was probably talking to Edward, and he thinks he was talking to you. So this Edward versus Ed Sr. Creates confusion sometimes. I hope it's clear by now, because you had Edward on the first show. And, of course, he's a 9-millimeter guy, and
right.
He's a sick guy, so I'm the 45 and the 1911 guy.
There you go. Now you guys understand. See, and I was guilty of that myself. For the longest time, I thought you guys were one and the same until
I
had Ed on the first show, and he cleared that up for us. So just so everybody knows, there's two Eds. There's Ed and there's Ed Sr., two different guys. One quick question about your work.
Okay.
Has stem cell research or stem cell things affected your line of work at all, and do you see it being something major in the future here?
No, not at all, and I don't anticipate this is going to have any effect on anything I do, because I'm planning on retiring soon. If Obamacare is as bad as I expect it to be, and contrary to what a lot of non-believers said on a threat they had going on where they said doctors would not retire, I'm getting out. If Obamacare isn't the bear that I think it's going to be, I might stay another couple of years or maybe 3 years. But as long as I enjoy what I'm doing, and as long as somebody says, as you enjoy what you do, it's not called work. And,
right.
You know, the alternative of staying home is not so appealing. I just think I would go crazy if I had to not do some work. I really enjoy it. So I don't think I'm going to stay around too long. But to answer your question on STEM research, that's mainly research. And from there till the time that they can use it to correct some diseases and deficiencies that someone may have, it's going to be a good 5 to 10 years at least.
Okay.
I would think.
My other question was going to be about Obamacare. You answered it partially. I know you said you will leave if it becomes what you think it's going to become. What about other doctors? What's the consensus that you've heard? Are people ready to really get out?
I don't know. It's really hard to tell you. The clinicians, and I'm not a clinician. A clinician would be someone who takes care of patients. I am, as I explained to you, basically a consultant to other physicians. But clinicians who depend a lot on Medicare payments and insurance third-party payers are not too happy about that. I don't think you're going to have a lot of people accepting Medicare if they keep reducing them, the 20% they said there is going to be reduced. Because what's the sense in working to get 80% of what your cost is?
Right.
Well, you got to live too. You got to pay malpractice, and you got to pay your staff. I work for the hospital. I don't have that problem, but still, I wouldn't want to be working out there under those conditions anyways, even though I don't get paid directly by Medicare or the insurance
sure.
companies. I get paid by the hospital. I'm basically an employee on a salary.
Okay. Let's go through
and
some of these questions.
I decided to do that because I don't want to have to deal with these insurances and billing people and having to worry about the business part of medicine. I just don't want anything to do with that.
Oh, okay, okay. You'd rather just work to heal people and have that be that?
I'd rather do that because that way I can concentrate on what I'm doing, and our system is one where whatever we do, we get paid. We all get paid the same, and that way we don't have to worry about, well, Joe is doing these cases because they paid better or whatever. Everybody does their share of work. And nobody worries about what they're going to get paid. I know other pathologists in other practices where, you know, they take pictures because they get paid a little extra, and that's how they make up on the reductions in payments. But I just don't have to worry about. I hate business, and I'm not. I didn't get into medicine to have to worry about whether I'm going to get paid $10 or $15. I just want to worry about diagnosing the patient and helping treat it if I can.
That's good. I like to hear that. And I couldn't be a doctor. I couldn't make it through med school, so the cadavers alone would just scare me to death.
Oh.
Let's knock out some of these questions, Ed. What is your favorite drink of choice when you're sitting down, surf a little ARFCOM or kick back at your house? What do you go to?
Honestly, in the summer, I like lemonade, and I sit out on my porch. We have a sort of a country home, and sit on the porch and watch a deer go by. And when I'm reading ARFCOM and I'm tense or something like that, I like to sip my Jack Daniels on the rocks.
Jack on the Rocks.
Favorite.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Do you have a favorite poster on ARFCOM? Someone that you like, just can't wait to see what they're going to post about something?
Honestly, I have some people that I like reading, but I don't have the luxury of going and following what anybody has said. I am generally reading threads, topics more than anything, just to make sure that everybody is complying with the rules and making sure they're not going overboard or attacking somebody. I'm just basically reading to keep the order. And sometimes I join in some conversations when I find it funny or something like that. I do tease some posters more than others, and that's because I know I'm fairly well, like IT Striker, and Aimless quite a bit because I know them personally, and I know that I have that kind of rapport with them, so I can say anything I want. They are not going to get upset. But I can't really say that I have too many favorite posters, let's put it that way.
Okay, fair enough. I'm going to skip past a couple of these questions. If you could live anywhere other than where you live now, where would that be?
I'd love to live in Alaska, but I like to live where my children and my grandchildren live. So if I could transplant them to Alaska, that would be where I would live.
I understand you love to hunt.
Yes, I do.
I love to hunt, too. What do you mostly hunt whitetail?
That's pretty much what I enjoy hunting. I have hunted, and I usually go out once or twice for turkey, but it doesn't really appeal to me as much as deer hunting because, I don't know, waiting for a gobbler to come to you, you know how dangerous it is to be calling and stalking a gobbler because it could be somebody that's hunting. So I don't quite like sitting down just calling and calling and calling. I like to walk around and and hunt deer that way, although a lot of my deer hunting is done from a stand, especially early in the morning and late in the afternoon. But, yeah, deer hunting is my favorite kind of game to hunt. Of course, we don't have wild boars. If I did have them, and I've gone to Texas and hunted with some of the guys, I Like Legs and TRG, and one gun runner has gone down there with me, or we have met over there. And that's something that I enjoyed as well. But we don't have that here, so I got to stick with the whitetail.
So we have a lot in common there. I actually love to hunt deer myself. I hunt mule deer out here where we live. And I've been pretty successful. I haven't ever shot a trophy. I've shot some pretty nice deer, though. But I would love to try to hunt mule deer. And if I ever got a chance to hunt hogs, oh, man, I would love to do that. That sounds like so much fun.
Yeah, it's fun.
Let's go down to the next question here. What is your favorite firearm that you currently own?
Well, I'm pretty sentimental, so I like the M1A1 that I have never shot but was given to me by a bunch of great guys from the website, and it's very special to me because not only did they give it to me by chipping in and putting their money together under the direction of Helldog 40, who was the instigator of this, but also because the owner of Fulton Armory, Clint McKee, had supposedly, the legend goes that he had put together a bunch of parts and set them aside to someday build himself an M1A. And so when these guys approached him about building an M1A for me, he graciously, or so the legend goes, took those parts that he had set aside and built it for me.
Oh, wow.
Built it in a hurry because I guess they called him and they needed it like 3 days later or a week later or something like that. So he was very gracious in putting it together with the parts that he had set aside for building his own.
Oh, that's a great story. I would love to have an M1A, let me tell you. I would love to have an M1A. If you could have any firearm that's legal for you to own, but you do not currently own, what would it be?
Oh, definitely a Thompson.
Oh,
I'd love to have a Thompson submachine gun.
Oh, yeah, those look so fun to shoot. I've never even shot one. I've seen one in a museum, but I've never shot one. I think they would be a lot of fun to shoot. When was the last time you went shooting, Ed?
I think it was, I was thinking about that. What am I going to answer? And I think it was the last time I went shooting, I went with two of my sons, JLA and Edward. We went to a course by MSTD on low light, I think it was low light tactical pistol. And
oh, okay.
That was last winter, I believe. So that was the last time. You know, winter, I live in upstate New York, and winter is pretty rough. Either you get a lot of snow and you cannot go out and shoot, or you get a lot of wind, which is what I hate, because, of course, it blows off all the targets, and it's really a pain in the neck. And I shoot primarily behind our house here, and so I got a field that I use that's got good places with backstops that are natural, and I can't do it when it's either when there's a lot of snow or when it's very windy,
right.
And I just haven't been able to do it. Now the weather has broken last week, and we're getting good weather now, so hopefully when the boys get here, Aimless or one of those guys comes around, maybe we'll go shooting again.
Okay. So you said you did some training with MDTS, was that right? Was that with Chris Fry?
Chris Fry, yeah. I love training with Chris. He's a very good trainer, but also someone who makes it fun, and I just enjoy training with him, not only in firearms, but also in with blades and without weapons. He's someone that I really, really enjoy training with.
Yeah, we had him on a previous show, and he's just, his programs, I love his approach to training. The guy makes it amazing to me. Yeah, I'd love to take one of his classes.
Yep.
Okay, let's move along here. What is the next question I have? I was looking at Chris Fry's website there while you were talking about him. Have you ever met a fellow ARFCARMer in real life? I know you have. What's your general impression of fellow ARFCARMers when you meet them?
Well, in general, you got your weird birds here and there. But in general, they're a great bunch of guys. They're fun to be with. One of the anecdotes that I always tell is that when we went to, I think it was Gunstock 1, and TJ, who was one of the owners of the range at the time, went around with me, and he was watching the guy shoot, mainly automatic weapons. And you got to remember that a lot of the guys, we had probably about 500 guys.
Oh, wow.
From the website on either of the gun stocks we had. And he came to me and he said, "Ed, these guys don't give a damn if they hit the target or not. They just like to see the dust fly." And I think he was right. And that's one of the anecdotes I always tell. There are a bunch of guys. Many of them are very competitive, but a lot of them just like to shoot for the fun of it. And that's what I like to do. I'm not a competition guy. I hate competition. I compete with myself. And sometimes I even lose competing just with myself. So competition is not a big incentive for me.
Yeah, it's like old Painless's motto, it's fun to shoot stuff. That's how our
absolutely, absolutely.
It's just fun to shoot stuff.
And I wish I shot more, but I can't. I don't have the time.
But you do have a range right there at the house, and of that I'm jealous.
Well, we don't have a... Edward keeps telling me and Juan keeps telling me we're going to build a range. Dad, let's build a range here. But we haven't done it yet. We just shoot in the back. I got like 30 acres in the back that I leased to a neighbor for hay because he has a lot of horses. And I really hate to take it away from him. And some of the other places that we have are just not good places for shooting. They will be closer to the houses, and I'm just not too crazy about it. One of these days they're going to convince me, and I'm going to convert that backfield into they want to build a shooting house also. And,
oh, wow.
Range. And we got enough distance there that we can probably shoot 400 or 500 yards without any problems, but I just haven't done it yet. So we just shoot in the back. Some will take the targets with us and set them up and shoot. But someday we'll build something.
Hey, what is your favorite non-GD section of the forums? I think I know the answer to this. I'm going to let you answer and see if I'm right.
Well, of course, it's got to be my pit.
Had to be the bear pit. What was the inspiration behind that? How'd you come up
with that? Well, I'll be honest with you. I had a lot of resistance from staff when we set up the pit, because my inspiration was more a necessity than anything else. My need was to give the guys a place where they can blow off steam and curse and attack each other with some rules. Those rules are no bringing in anybody from somebody else's family, relatives, or out of bounds. Also, I didn't want any racist stuff in there. And just a few, and no threats of violence either. But if they wanted to call each other a-hole or whatever, they could do it there and not get locked. And I wanted to do it because also, not only would they blow off steam, but they also would try to, in some cases, and I was hoping it would be more than we actually have, but they would try to resolve their differences and shake hands and go back to the board and ignore each other or become friends, but at least be neutral to each other and stop the bickering. And I don't know to what degree I have accomplished that, but at least it gives you a place. It's a venue for guys who are getting just fed up with somebody else, and they say, okay, let's go over there and blow off some steam. But staff didn't want it because they would think that they were thinking that it would sort of entice guys to become more belligerent than they were, and you know, as the old saying that guns increase violence, crimes like flies increase the number of garbage dumps or whatever the saying is. You know, the fact that you have a place to vent is not going to make the guys become more aggressive. That's my opinion. So that was my inspiration for asking Juan to give me a pit.
I'll tell you what, it is very entertaining, the bear pit. There's some of the best, the funniest threads and the funniest
comments. Sometimes it's hilarious, but sometimes it gets out of hand, too.
It is a great place. So, we've got just a couple more minutes here, so let me skip another one of these questions. But I want to know, what is the first firearm you ever shot? Do you remember?
Oh, sure. The first firearm I shot, and I've told this story before, was an M1 Garand. And I shot it at fish in the water in a river. So it was a way of fishing. If you want to put it that way. And what it did is they told me, shoot next to the fish and the concussion will knock him out for a little bit. And there was a guy that would go in the water and pick up the fish. And that's what we were going to have for lunch. So I was about 12 when I shot the Garand.
And did it work? Did you get a fish?
Oh, yeah. We got plenty of fish.
That is a great story. And then after that, you just loved firearms ever since then.
After that, I always liked them. My father wasn't too crazy about them. But after that, I asked him to buy me a .22, and that took about 3 years. And then Castro took over and didn't let anybody own any guns. So I had to give it away to some people who were members of the Communist Party who were friends of ours. And then they kept it. And then I left and... who knows where it is now?
Oh, you're originally from Cuba. I did not know that.
Yes, I came when I was almost 14.
Oh, wow. So you seem quite a bit
over there.
I was
back in January of 1961.
What do you think is going to happen when Fidel passes away? Do you think things will change? Do you think the U.S. will drop their embargo?
I don't know. I don't think so. Not as long as you have this regime. If things are relaxed and Raul passes away or some of the Communist Party loses some of the tight nose they hold on the population, maybe things will change and they'll have actual free elections. But I don't hold my breath, and I have nothing to go back to anyways, or nothing to see. All my family has either moved out or died, or I don't care about whoever's left behind anymore.
Okay.
So
you've got all your family here. That's good to hear.
I got most of my family here. I'm sure I have some cousins that I haven't... Well, actually, I do have a cousin who is one of Castro's best physicists.
Oh, wow.
And he comes out and he gives lectures sometimes in the States, actually. And he'd be the only one I'd be interested in talking to, but
okay.
Nobody else.
This will be our last question, Ed. We're just about out of time. I always go over every week. I want to know a little bit about your avatar. I love your avatar, and just tell us a little bit about it.
Well, my avatar was a regular run-of-the-mill generic AR-15.com avatar, and then I think a bunch of guys led by 82nd Airborne made that avatar for me, and as you see it change from one thing to another, it has my second 504 unit emblem, and then it changes to the Vietnamese ribbon, and I forgot, it's got a CIB, and I forgot what else it has. Oh, the 82nd patch.
Yeah.
So he made that for me. I don't know who helped him or not, and you'll notice that it's faded, sort of blurry, and guys have told me to change it. I don't know how to change it. I don't care to either. I like it like that. My eyes are seeing everything blurry anyway, so even if I get it sharp, it's going to look blurry to me anyhow.
Oh, Ed, I really want to thank you for taking some time out coming on and being
thank
on the
you.
Show. I know our listeners loved every minute of this interview like I did, just to get to know you better. You're just like this legendary figure on ARFCOM, and it's great to get to know you a little bit better.
Well, thank you, John. And remember, boys, 45, not 9 millimeters.
You heard it from Ed Sr. Oh, I really appreciate it, getting him on. I wish we'd had more time for him. We will definitely make sure we get this podcast up as soon as possible tonight. So for anybody who missed part of the interview with Ed or with Ted, we'll make sure you get to listen to it. Our next guest coming up, we had him on a couple weeks ago. A lot of you know who he is. His blog is Sipsey Street Irregulars, .blogspot.com. His name's Mike Vanderbo. He was the original author of a short piece, short story called The Window War. I think that was 15, 20 years ago when he wrote that. And with the recent events with the passing of the Obamacare bill, he proposed that people actually start the window war up on his blog. And since then, there have been numerous windows broken on both Republicans and Democrats' offices. And it's interesting to know that he wrote this 20 years ago, and now he proposed it, and it's kind of come to fruition. He's made the talk circuit show the talk show circuits in the last week. He's been quoted on MSNBC. That Rachel Maddow dude definitely does not like him at all. And we've got him on now, Mike Vanderbo. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing fine. I just don't know, you know, how I can deal with rejection from Rachel Maddow.
I always call it Mr. Rachel Maddow, but hey, whatever.
That
so,
too. We have a lot in common, you know. We both like women.
Oh, God. All right. Let's talk a little bit about this window war. It picked up some steam. There were some windows broken in Democrat headquarters. And then I guess the liberals, the collectivists, as you like to call them, they decided they were going to join in as well, huh?
Yeah. Actually, they're probably running about even with us right now. They even broke windows in Marion, Ohio, which is a town that I grew up in some time ago, but it's funny, the Republicans were quite perplexed. Why are they breaking our windows? You know, I mean, what did we ever do to offend them? But they don't understand. This is a war, right? Right now it's with rocks. Later on it'll be with something else, because we represent two different philosophical worldviews about which is to be the master, the government, or the people.
Yeah, I read on your blog today, actually, you had that piece by Jeffrey Kuhner from the Washington Times. I was just amazed that the Washington Times would even print something like that. Well, I guess I wasn't amazed, but it was just surprising to see stuff like that being talked about in the mainstream media, that our country is polarized more than ever. It's not getting less polarized. It's only getting more polarized as the days go by, and sir, it seems like, you know, some things are inevitable.
Yeah, I wish it was different. I truly do. I wish that you know, God would find some way to stop this. I don't know. You know, the interesting thing, in a sick and twisted sort of way, is how misunderstood the gesture was. They act as if, you know, I'm trying to declare war on them, when in fact I'm trying to get them to see that if they don't get themselves under control, they're going to provoke a civil war. It's war I'm trying to prevent by suggesting that folks do this. And they totally missed the point. And as far as making the talk show circuit, you know, almost everybody that's denounced me, from the left collectivists to so-called conservatives, they won't give me a chance to go on their show. And that includes, you know, Rachel Maddow and all of that ilk over there. But it also includes people like Hugh Hewitt, Dennis Prager, Jonah Goldberg. None of them. Michael Medved. They've all denounced me, and yet when I ask them, you know, for equal time, you know, How about arguing with the real Mike Vanderbilt instead of a straw man that you just hung my name around? They won't have anything to do with it. You know, I can't get on these shows to try to refute some of these points. And you expect that of the collectivists. You expect that of the Rachel Maddows of the world. But, you know, Dennis Prager, Jonah Goldberg, come on.
Yeah, that's
but
surprising.
No, they're more comfortable with putting me in a particular place, you know, and drawing me as a straw man and knocking me down instead of listening to what I really have to say and why I really call people to do this.
I wanted to talk a little bit about these Huttery. Is that how you pronounce it? The Huttery militia?
I think it's Huttari.
Huttari. Okay.
I'm told that comes from a Shawnee word meaning stupid white man.
Anyway,
that may or may not be true, but it certainly should be.
Let's talk a little bit about how this these raids came about. How I know you've got some connections with some of the militias in Michigan, not the Hutteries in specific, but some of the other militias up there. What do you know of this? And tell us a little bit about how this came about. I assume there was some type of informant or an inside agent.
Well, as near as we can determine, they actually had an FBI agent in amongst them, if you believe the supporting statements in the indictment. And then there was an admission that they had somebody inside the whole time. And apparently, it was this guy that kept pushing them to the whole IED kill a cop thing. At some point, you have to ask yourself, you know, was this just some sort of put up job? They found some credulous morons to go along with it. And at some point, you know, where their internal compass got screwed up and they just decided to go along with this. But again, we don't know whether Huttari are actually guilty of what they say. Now, based on what my buddies in Michigan say, who, you know, started staying away from them 2 years ago because they were making such ridiculous, threatening statements to everybody. My guys up there say they're perfectly prepared to believe that the provocateur got them where he wanted them, probably quite willingly, at least for part of it. The interesting thing to me is the allegation in the indictment that they were attempting to craft a quote-unquote WMD, by which they meant an improvised explosive device with an explosively formed penetrator. Apparently, the guy maneuvered them into either selling or giving this information to a second agent or second party that was controlled by the government. So that's significant because just mention WMD, and that means you can pull in the military in this country. We have a report from one of the news media folks who were circulating around there that they saw guys in blue Hummers that were dressed in full battle rattle, looking, as the reporter said, like they had just dropped out of Afghanistan. And in at least one of these blue Hummers, they had an anti-tank weapon. It was described by the reporter as a bazooka. It turns out that it apparently was an AT-4. Now,
oh, wow.
This raises, this raises some questions. Now, we are informed that the FBI hostage roasting team is not issued anti-tank weapons. So we have three choices, all of them rather intriguing. One is that this is some new Department of Homeland Security nut-busting group, some special deal that they've put together for such things. The other is that they might be contractors, on the order of Blackwater Z.
Right.
And the third is that they were that they were Delta. Now, you can justify Delta if you believe that this was actually a WMD incident, which I do not. But if this is a new bone-breaking outfit of the Department of Homeland Security, that's news. And if it's, if instead it's a case of contractors being used in this, that also is news. And I would suspect that even the quote-unquote liberals would go nuts if they found out that Blackwater was helping execute search warrants within the continental United States.
Oh, yeah, that's almost unbelievable to think about.
So there's, I understand there's been some FOIA requests filed on this. The reporter is trying to follow this up. That would be an interesting story when we find that out, however it turns out. Because using anti-tank weapons to serve a warrant, I don't care how dangerous you think the group is. I mean, nobody, you know, they don't bring anti-tank weapons to bust MS-13.
No, they don't.
Okay. You know, this is another order of magnitude greater than we've seen so far. So I will be very interested to see, you know, how that turns out. Whether the Hutari are guilty or not also remains to be determined. But, you know, what we do know is that they were pretty loose with their talk and very loose with their threats, to the point where responsible guys just didn't want to have anything to do with them, because they viewed them as a federal entrapment waiting to happen.
So the regular militia guys, they kind of could see something like this coming down the road, huh?
Yeah. Now, the guys I'm closest to up in Michigan, that's not, I'm not talking about like the Michigan militia or the Southeast Volunteer Michigan militia that was apparently quite close to them up to a point. And we're in their AO. The guys I know are very highly trained, very professional, and they have their own independent formations, and they're very, very careful with whom they link up, because they understand that their reputation is on the line.
Now, I'll admit, I know next to nothing about militias. My education comes basically from what I can get off the internet and what few stories there are on the news or whatnot. But when people hear about militia, they think, you know, a big fat redneck guy who puts on a colonel's insignia on his hat and goes out with a bunch of his buddies and shoots. But the more I read and research, there actually are some pretty professional outfits out there.
There's some guys that are scary professional. I mean, very, very good. Most of those units are operated by retired, you know, special operations guys, retired light infantry guys, guys, frankly, who have retired but still see that their country needs them. So they do things like, for example, there's a fellow here in Alabama who's retired special forces, and he does nothing but train cadre. He turns out, by the time he's done with these guys, they're suitable to be an NCO in any militia formation, and they're also cross-trained and able to teach, you know, various and sundry things like the basics of light infantry, land nav, medicine, stuff like that. And that's all he does, is he sits there and cranks these guys out on a regular basis every 6 weeks or so. So there's a whole lot of preparation going on in this country right now, and about 95% of it is off the radar.
Right. As I'm sure they want to keep their OPSEC as tight as they can. The other thing you hear about...
It only makes sense. I mean, look at the Hutari.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The other thing that you hear a lot, and that a lot of people are worried about, when they hear the word militia, they equate it with some type of racist movement. Now, of course, there's racist movements out there. That can't be denied. But in your opinion, if you had to put a number on, if you had to put a percentage on it, how many of these organized armed groups, what percentage would you say are actually are motivated by a racism or some type of ideology like that?
I mean, first of all, and here I suggest that people who really want to study the subject get a hold of one book. It's by Professor Robert Churchill. It's called To Shake Their Guns in the Tyrant's Face. And it's a history of the militia movement in the 90s, but also traces what it calls the libertarian impulse of political violence straight back to the founders. There is the constitutional militia movement, and then there is what we call the millennials, okay, who seem to be quite concerned with conspiracy theories of various kinds.
Okay.
And then, of course, the neo-Nazis and the sheetheads. That's the Klan. Sorry, little inside stuff. We call them sheetheads.
I knew who you were talking about.
The thing is that to be a constitutional militiaman, you can like or dislike anyone that you wish. However, you must agree that the Constitution extends to everyone, regardless of race, creed, color, or religion. Now, if you stutter on that subject, then you're not a constitutional militia guy. Okay, you're generally a what they call the millennials. That's what Churchill called them, or you know, some of the racist formations. I mean, we don't have a test in the constitutional militia movement over who you like and who you dislike. What we do have a test is that when you raise your right hand to God and you swear to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you understand that extends to everyone, okay, except those domestic and foreign enemies. So if you've got somebody who say is black and don't like white folks, or is white and don't like black folks, or, you know, is Hispanic and don't like anybody, as long as they adhere to extending rights to everyone regardless of race, creed, color, religion, then, yeah, sure.
Okay, so if you had to put a percentage on it of the ones that, you know, of the racist formations, the Klan formation, of the total militia population.
The constitutional militia movement is Lord, at least 20 times bigger than these collectivist formations of various kinds.
Okay.
And see, you know, we consider the Nazis to be, you know, racial collectivists, you know, or in some sense even tribal collectivists. The individual means nothing compared to their collective. Okay, constitutional militia people, however, are motivated by individual liberties, by the founders' concept of limited government, free men and free markets, that sort of thing. I got a nasty note today from somebody in the League of the South, and told me how I was just leading white folks down the path, and I really needed to sign on to their, you know, secessionist idea. And I just sent him an email back and said, you mean the League of the South that pays homage to Kirk Lyons, a guy who is a neo-Nazi, married into the Aryan Brotherhood, and a guy who's also an FBI snitch? You mean that League of the South you want me to sign on to? You know, I don't think so. Most of these racist groups are and have been wholly owned subsidiaries of the FBI. I mean, it's as bad or worse as in the 50s and 60s when, you know, the communists would say, can we start the cell meeting now? And the joke was, no, the FBI guy hasn't shown up to take the notes. You know, the FBI has done a very, very good job from their point of view of infiltrating racist groups, neo-Nazi groups, the so-called Christian identities, who I call mistaken identities because I don't think there's anything Christian about them. As a matter of fact, I was quoted back in the 90s as saying that in an article in, I think it was Slate, that Christian identity is for panty waists, which made them all very mad. And I explained that, you know, Christian identity is like neo-Nazism with a veneer of so-called Christianity. It's for those guys who have to explain to their wives and sweethearts that it's okay that we hate blacks and Jews, dear, because God and Jesus told it was okay. Whereas the Nazis, you know, they're sort of beyond excuses. If you've got a standard bearer like Adolf Hitler, what else is there to apologize for?
Right.
So,
some of these questions I have for you, they're just guilty pleasure questions of my own, stuff that I've always wondered about the militia. So I'm sure there's other people that have wondered. When you talk about these militias, you got all these different groups in all these different states. How much actual communication goes on between the different groups and between the different states, say, between like an Indiana militia and a New Mexico militia, or a Texas militia and an Alabama militia? How much are they, do they talk with one another? Do they communicate with one another? Do they have that type of thing going on? Or is it all these little
in the model, groups? In the model from the 90s, quite a bit. You know, there would be national meetings and things like that. In terms of, say, Alabama and New Mexico, we've long had a very close relationship with Bob Wright's First New Mexico. And, you know, we've gone out there to train, and they've come here to train. So, in effect, there's quite a few interesting stories about how Western boys react to the strange sights of lightning bugs, because they don't have any bugs out west whose behinds light up.
No.
And, first time they see lightning bugs, they think there's a flashing light coming toward them. But, there's all sorts of cross-pollinization. Again, I would refer you to Churchill's book. It's an outstanding, very complete, it's the most complete history of the militia movement in the 90s that you could find.
And what was the title of that again?
The most intellectually honest and unbiased.
What was the title of that again?
It's called To Shake Their Guns in the Tyrant's Face. It was published last year by the University of Michigan Press. And the author's name is Professor Robert Churchill.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to have to pick that up and read it. I just always had this weird, you know, interest in the militias, especially since the early 90s when they first started getting more national prominence. I was like, well, what are these guys about? You know, where are they coming from? They get a lot of bad press. I don't, you know, a lot of people, the only thing they get is from the mainstream media, so they really don't know what's going on.
And Churchill's book is very effective, too, in putting the lie to some of that. He admits in the beginning of the book that he started out looking at whatever documents that the Southern Poverty Law Center, or as we call them, the Southern Preposterous Law Center, and the ADL had in their whatever original militia documents they had in their collections. But he resisted their spin on the thing, and ultimately came to the conclusion that that by crafting what they call the narrative, what he calls the narrative of 1995, in other words, racist equal Tim McVeigh equal constitutional militias, throwing us all in the same bag and conflating us all together. He concluded that what they were really trying to do, for whatever reason, and in the case of the SPLC, is just shaking people down for money, was creating a second brown scare. You know, we've had our red scares, but we also had our brown scares in this country. And Churchill goes a long way to explain the history of these various hysterias and critiques them. You know, he rejected the SPLC line, the ADL line about militias, saying that you would never write a history of any group by referring to what their enemies said about them. And he was quite right.
Yeah,
in my case, he came down here, interviewed me for like 6 hours. There were follow-up questions by email. I opened up my archives to him, and he carried off a large box of documents that he took his time going through, and then was kind enough to send them back. And I mentioned in the book a few times. But he did a very, very rigorous and intellectually honest history of us. And he's not one of us by any means, but he's just an honest historian, which has not been good for his career.
Hey, Mike, we're out of time. I really appreciate you spending time with us, letting us know a little bit more about the situation with the Hutteri and with the militias in general. I know some of the questions I asked, I'm sure there's other people who were curious about that. His blog is sipsystreetirregulars.blogspot.com, and it's not 100% militia. It's not 100% of anything. He's got a whole range of different stuff that he talks about on there. Very interesting. I know most ARFCOMers have checked it out at one point or another. If you haven't, please check it out again. And thanks again for being on the show with us, Mike.
Oh, you're welcome. Hope to see you in Washington on April 19th.
Oh, that's right. You have the march on April 19th, correct?
The there's the unarmed march across the river in the District of Criminals, and then there's our armed march in Virginia.
Okay, so
an interesting time will be had by all.
Yeah, that will definitely be interesting. I'll keep my eyes on that. Thanks again for being on the show.
All right, take care.
You too. That's Mike Vanderbilt from Sipsy Street Irregulars. We had a great show. Ed Sr. came on and gave us all kinds of insight into his personal life. For everybody who didn't know about Ed Sr., if you missed that interview, we'll get the podcast up as soon as possible. It might be a little later tonight than usual. I try to get it up in an hour. It might be a couple hours tonight because my recording went down halfway through, so I missed a bunch of it. I have to wait and get it from the studio. I want to thank Ted Bellman from IsraelPundit.com. Gave us a lot of good insight on Israel. Joe DeVergolace, as always. Love having him on the show, and him and I are putting together an outstanding show for the 26th of this month. Mark it on your calendar, write it on the back of your hand, whatever you have to do to remember. It's not something you're going to want to miss, I promise. If you are an ARFCOMer, if you are a gun lover, you are going to want to listen to that show. It's going to be very, very special. And also, on the 19th, in 2 weeks, we are going to have representatives from Bushmaster and Magpul on the show to talk about the ACR. They're going to give away a lot of free, cool, free stuff, so you're not going to want to miss that show. Next week, I'll have all kinds of surprises for you right here on Radio Free ARFCOM. Before we leave, I want to thank Seth, our producer engineer. He does a great job, as always. I want to thank Meryl, who updates the show discussion posts with all kinds of pictures and links and stuff so that everybody can go along on AR15.com during the threads and listen to the show at the same time. He keeps it moving. We really appreciate Meryl. And that's it for this week. We'll see you guys next week on Radio Free ARFCOM. God bless America.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.